coming here. Obviously, you guys are the activists, so. I'm not going to necessarily introduce the panel, I'm going to leave that to them, but I am going to say that we have a great panel put together this year. We've got Doug Olson from Microsoft, David Tinglestad from Dow Jones, Michael Gorman, Split Rock Partners, Robert Stevens from Geek Squad, Dan Bigsby, recent 40 Under 40 recipient from the Iowa City Paul Business Journal. And,
Jamie too,
I guess. Yeah, and then Matthew Dornquist from Code 42. So this is open-ended. There's a lot of room for questions. I have some written up. I'll probably just launch into one, but we'll also take questions from the crowd, and I'll try to come on as far as this will reach. So if you do have questions, maybe even like form a line in this aisle. But first, let me have the panelists introduce themselves.
I guess I'll go first. As Jamie Thiel said, actually formally of Dow Jones, yesterday was my final day at Dow Jones, capping off a over 10-year stint of running a fairly large internet operation here in Minneapolis that built and deployed BigTrust.com, then built and ran and operated MarketWatch.com to be one of the largest financial websites on the planet, and then was purchased by Dow Jones and ran the Wall Street Journal Digital Network for the last couple of years, and happily a Minnesota resident and not moving, so moving on to start some new ventures in the fall.
Hi, my name is Robert Stevens. My title is founder and chief inspector of the Geek Squad. When you start your own company, you can call yourself anything you want. And calling myself CEO of a one-person company when I started seemed kind of arrogant. I'd really love to have a couple more startups, but I'm still trying to wrap up my first one. And just kind of keeps going on and on. And I hope to explain today a little bit why the hell I'm here and what it has to do with companies.
Hi guys, I'm Dan Grigsby. During the 90s, I was a couple of time .com CEO, moved out to Silicon Valley, spent a few years there, and then got drawn back to Minnesota. And so for the last 5 years, I've been, maybe a catalyst is a good way to describe it. I've been trying to work to get folks to start companies, put people together. I've been active in trying to help organize these kind of things. I'm kind of everyone's free labor. I'm very enthusiastic about the Twin Cities as a startup market. We've got a great pool of really, really good engineering talent here. And I want to see that turn into something interesting. And so I'm on the panel to talk about that.
Doug Olson, I work for Microsoft. And yes, it's kind of maybe not the most popular thing to say to this crowd. But I represent the new Microsoft. That's right, Rick that has an office here building product here. But actually, my background actually goes back to the very first startup that I was ever involved in. Mr. Steve Borsch in front of me was involved in this too. A little company called Authorware, back down in the mid-80s, and moved out to California. And kind of ever since that whole thing, moving out to California, I have been involved in primarily building tools for the design space, whether 7-plus years at Adobe, a bunch of years. Actually, an author became Macromedia, did another startup after Adobe. It got acquired by Macromedia, so I was back there again. I have been this whole crazy West Coast, sort of Midwest thing. And I'm actually anchored here because my wife lives here, and my children live here, So this thing with Microsoft is just a recent thing, actually. After spending 2-plus years at Microsoft laboring on the in Seattle, we've actually convinced the company to actually invest in this world. And I'll tell you more about that if you guys have questions about why. But we've had just great success, and that's great.
My name is Ben Dornquist. I work for Code42 Software. We're a small team of developers, and we build products for startups. And we've been doing this for 6 years. We've launched a startup every year. None of them were our own until about a year and a half ago. We launched a product called CrackPlan, and that's been going very well. So, small group, you know. So, hope to answer any questions you have about being a startup in Minnesota or what it's like, you know, in terms of, I think it was a blast, mini bar. I spoke about all of our mistakes, which went really well. So if you care to hear about our mistakes, I can tell you what not to do. And I've got a few things that worked out okay as well.
We've got a lot of mistakes to go around up here. We can talk about those as well. My name is Michael Gorman. I'm with Split Rock Partners, which is a venture capital firm. We're headquartered here in the Twin Cities. We've got an office in Silicon Valley as well, and are very active as investors in two different sectors. Internet services and software is where I focus my time, and that's where half of our fund is focused, and the rest is on healthcare and medical devices. Minnesota is a core part of what we do. It's a core part of our belief in that there are compelling opportunities here. Folks in this room, folks on this table are testament to that. So we've invested over time over $200 million in Minnesota-based startup opportunities. Have 16 portfolio companies in Minnesota today, and are committed to investing in Minnesota, not because we're here and because we grew up here and because we love the state, but because we think there are compelling opportunities and compelling entrepreneurs and folks in this room and others who are out trying to build kick-ass companies, and we would like to support them and be a part of that. Thanks.
All right, well, this is sort of billed as a panel of the state of technology in Minnesota, the state of the state. One of the panelists, Dan Greasby, has made a couple comments on his blog. He says that he has a proposal basically to allow Minnesota companies to attract well-known software and IT companies here. And two other panelists have actually experienced with this, with Jamie and Doug, both working on different coasts and then also forming here. So I basically present a question to Dan, Jamie, and Doug on just how have your experiences been working on the coast, and then how are they different here?
Well, sure. I guess I'll lead off with that. I'm going to try to just speak loudly and not gawk over the mic too much here. I kind of came up with this idea, looking at the success stories of the folks here at the table. We have a long track record in Minnesota of having really successful products produced for big, well-known companies. We've got now Microsoft. We've had Dow Jones. We have Adobe. We have Oracle. When you look at the who's who of software, there have been a lot of success stories tied to those companies and to Minnesota developers. So I have this idea that we can, as a community, embrace this. And I think there's a really nice side effect to this. I think that there's a fundamental difference between building software where software is the business versus building software where you're supporting another business. So I think that there's a mindset and a skill set and a way of approaching things that's different for folks when what you're building is software as the business. And I think that if we can encourage that in this market, we're going to take what is already an outstanding set of developers. And so to directly answer the question, I put Minnesota developers up against coastal developers any day of the week. I want to take those folks, and I want to be able to launch them into entrepreneurial things, and I want them to be able to see software as the business. So I want you out of the banks and into the startups, in effect. And so that's kind of the basis for it. I'd love to hear the other folks who are doing the software development here and kind of their experience vis-a-vis the coast. Maybe Jamie, you want to take that over?
Yeah, it's interesting, because this is a question that's asked a lot. I typically answer this question in the context of somebody who's fairly centric to either the East Coast or the West Coast, and kind of questioning, well, you know, can you really build a development shop in Minneapolis? You know, there's nothing there, right? It's just, we fly and we land, my experience, you know, speaking from where I sit, you know, there is truth to, you have to take as a given that you can build a core team anywhere. So, you know, there's no inherent nature of building a team here in Minnesota and in Minneapolis is going to give you extra skills and capabilities. But what I can say is that my experience has been that the general tenor of talent in the cities is, on average, pretty high. I attribute that to something that I kind of call the Hollywood factor. In that, you know, if you are in software development and you're maybe just kind of you want to be that great developer, there is a magnetic attraction to the coast, because there are a lot of startups that are trying to hire people, and I've been pretty amazed at the lack of talent in some of the startups that I've seen on the coast. And in part, I think it's like the struggling actor is really not all that great, but they need to go to Hollywood because that's where the job is. Really good actors can be anywhere and do great things. And so I think that you know, the kind of wannabe level has a tendency to migrate there because that's where you can get a high volume of opportunities. But I mean, the talent that we have here, I think on average is really high. One thing that I do think is interesting as well is that there's a lot of tendency to believe that, and I make a contrary of one point that Dan, I think, has made in passing, is that maybe it's cheaper. And not really, at least in my experience, maybe for entry-level talent. But you know, if you're a great engineer, moving to the coast is not going to get you some big, huge jump in salary. You got to pay for talent anyway, and we're not that different than the other regions that I've always operated in. So.
I think on that, on the cost differential, clearly, if what your goal is to save labor costs in building products, you'll do that in China, you'll do that in India, you'll do that in Vietnam, whatever. That's the delta in cost, if there is any. Frankly, my experience has been, and it has been really important to drive home that great engineer is a unit of cost, and it's really very little differential. It's kind of an attraction for somebody in Minnesota to get paid the same you get paid in California, because you actually take, you know, less of that is in your home cost, for example, if you're living in San Francisco. But back in 1990, it's kind of a strange journey for me. In 1990, I had the opportunity to start this whole new development team for this little company called Authorware. I was convinced that I couldn't hire the team in Minnesota. I just knew it because, you know, the coasts. And we ended up choosing to move the whole company out to California because I was so convinced that the Bay Area, Silicon Valley, you know, was filled with all of these great opportunities. And what was interesting was the struggle of a little tiny company from Minnesota trying to hire people in California. And what we found was is the best developers we ended up hiring, oddly enough, came from, you know, Minnesota, Iowa, Michigan, you know, from the Big Ten schools, frankly, which is really, really interesting. And coming back in 1995 and establishing the office for Adobe, you know, we were able to bring in super top talent, people who had been on the coast, one or the other, and chose to move back because they'd had some tie here, or they just never left. And they're every bit as good as it. In fact, I would say in many ways, less distractions, generally better, and very loyal. So I'll say most of the people that I hired in 1995 and on at Adobe are still there at the little office in Arden Hills, which is pretty amazing, frankly. And I've done this now a couple times at a startup, and it was acquired by Macromedia. We built a giant office, giant 40-person all-product development office near the University of Minnesota campus. It was great. Now back here, and we've had just nothing but success in hiring really, really top people. And so, frankly, it's just been a wealth of talent, and I love it. So,
I'll just toss in my two cents. I grew up in Chicago. I've lived in Minnesota almost 20 years, and I was attending one of the other sessions this morning. We talked about, you know, the Eastern European programmers, and we're like a Russia of America. We don't have the distractions of mountains and skiing and surfing. I tell people, and they're like, well, why is Silicon Valley so productive? I said, only geeks. They don't know it's sunny outside. I think we're talking about a sense of place. We're talking about the origins of the Midwest, the ethical, hardworking, all that kind of stuff. And it's no accident. It you know, every, not January, it's in March when you really decide how bad you want to live here. You know, when we got socked with that snow 2 weeks ago after it was 70 degrees out, that's when you truly are Minnesotan, when you still live after that. So while it's humorous, I think that applies. And unlike Hollywood, where you still have to have lighting technicians and equipment and the props departments and that whole infrastructure, it is, you can code from anywhere. And I think increasingly, you're seeing in Minnesota, if you look at all these little restaurants starting up in the Twin Cities, a lot of chefs are moving from New York and LA to the Midwest because they're into farming, organic agriculture, and all that kind of stuff. It's even easier to operate the software development, especially with the low cost of development.
I have one comment on this, just from an investor's perspective, and I think relevant for all of us in the room who care deeply about companies succeeding in this market. I do think we have to be careful to make sure that we are constantly scanning and staying very engaged in what the absolute benchmark of excellence is, meaning when you look at what Doug has done and what Jamie has done in terms of building their respective organizations, they are absolutely playing at the top level of the game being played in the software marketplace. And clearly you're doing fantastic work as well, and I know Dan's done that. I think that it's easy for us, I'm a huge booster of the talent that's in Minnesota and a huge booster of the capabilities that are represented in this room. I think a part of what difference, one of the great qualities of a development community is that it is constantly striving to be the best, to benchmark itself relative to world-class standards. I believe those standards can be completely met and exceeded by folks in Minnesota, but we shouldn't kid ourselves that the marketplace isn't a global marketplace with absolutely rigorous, brutal standards. So capital can flow from an investor's perspective anywhere. There's tons of capital out there to back promising startups, but it's going to go to the most compelling opportunities and the most compelling teams. We believe that there's folks in Minnesota who are hitting that standard on a regular basis. But there's no question that in California or in Boston or in Austin, there's a greater density of some of those teams, right? And that's a part of why this conference is so valuable and important. I think a part of our challenge in Minnesota is to make sure that the folks who are about that business and about that prospect are functioning in a denser set of networks and connections and interconnections than we've had historically. That essentially we need a set of molecules in a smaller vessel to bounce off one another and have the temperature of the gas increase. And that's a part of what I think is so powerful about this. And I think Ben, Luke, Dan, and the team have pulled this together because I think it's a necessary component of Minnesota's evolution. So I apologize for the long-winded kind of vector here, but I guess the basic point is we should want to be not just the best developers in the Midwest, not the best developers in the center of the country that's not the coast. We want to be the best developers and the best company creators in the country and in the world based on the performance of the businesses, based on the performance of the code. And that's the aspiration we need to have, because that's the standard you're ultimately going to face when it gets out into the marketplace and when you're seeking capital and the like. So that's part of what I think is so encouraging to me about the quality of what is taking place in the Twin Cities. This stuff is world class. You guys are world class, but we need to make sure we continue to not rest on that, but benchmark ourselves against the best that's out there, and keep our feet rooted on the ground here in the Midwest, but keep our eyes scanning the horizon for everything that's out there.
So I'd like to add to that. So I'm kind of been on record a lot of saying we've got really, really, really good developers. What I feel like we need more of, and I'd love to get the panel's view on this, is people who get the business of software. And so I want to expound upon this a little bit. I'll try to keep it short. I think that before I made the comment about building software where software is the business as being fundamentally different than building software to support a business, I think that is a multiplier when it comes to the business people. We've got good developers, but one of the things I find is that it's very hard to find the executive team and the folks who get the sales aspect and all of these things. And so my answer to this kind of has come in two prongs in the thrust. One of them is, I think you got to get folks when they're young. So in the fall, there's a class, I'm teaching it here, it's software entrepreneurialism. I think that there's a kind of an interesting point in a young engineer's life where you can make the decision to be an entrepreneur or not. And you can make a bunch of mistakes at that point, and then along the way, you're going to learn a bunch of stuff. Another thing I think that is that if you are a product manager for Microsoft or for Adobe or for Dow Jones, particularly online stuff, you build a skill set that it's hard to get from a non-software as a business perspective. And so one of the reasons I'd like to see kind of an active effort to pull in big established companies and frankly to compete for the same people that I want to put into startups is because I think there's going to be an ecosystem or a structure that forms around that. St. Paul got formed because of its proximity to Fort Snelling. I want a Fort Snelling of coastal software companies to pull in developers, and then I want to basically pull them out of there and get good software business people out of that. So I'm interested in hearing from the table here, how do we get, frankly, better business people? We've got good, but the number of them isn't as dense, and so to your molecules in the vessel, I'd like more software business people. I'd love to hear your feedback on it.
Well, it's about leadership, ultimately, and you're right. Great leadership is hard to find. I don't care where you are. They don't grow on trees, whether you're in the valley or whether you're here or Boston. It doesn't really matter. One of the challenges that I think, and it's a big issue, and we're here sitting in the Howard Halls of the University of Minnesota, University of Minnesota is not a top computer science school. It's not a top school for business, frankly, and it ought to be, frankly. And I think it is a challenge. So just in terms of growing leaders. And so that is a challenge. I don't know the answer for it, but that's it.
Sure. So I think tactically, product managers are future CEOs. How are more product managers? That's kind of oversimplified.
Well, one of the reasons I'm here is one of the reasons Geeks acquired Best Buy. you're trying to grow your business. I mean, we're the janitors of the IT industry. We're not even the technology industry. We're more like a restaurant. We're just kind of serving the meals up. If the Wi-Fi's not working, nobody's going to use your applications. But there's only a couple ways you grow a company. You IPO, and service is profitable, but not profitable enough for a quarter to quarter on Wall Street. I don't want investors to buy and sell this company and kind of rip it apart. But service is really, really hard to get. Geeks to shower more than once a week and show up on time and be really technically good is really hard. What startups lack is leverage. Well, they have innovation, a lot of ideas, and what the big companies have is leverage, and that's what I wanted. You know, geeks love to debug, so I wanted to, when I was a startup in the warehouse district while I was still a student here, I couldn't get Microsoft on the phone if I had an idea. If I'd advised on Vista, I would have said, boy, you know, also make an operating system that boots up twice as fast and crashes half as long. We had some people involved.
Sorry, it was 5,000.
What's that? I know. And that's part of the problem. So here's the opportunity that I see. The reason I stayed inside Best Buy, because I studied, most founders get kicked out or quit within 18 months, either because, and I think deep down it's because, you have to move out of your comfort zone, what you're in control of. And I thought, well, there's two ways to change the world. You can either pick it across the street from the White House or take a job inside and start hacking things apart from the inside. So my dream is to kind of turn the Death Star into a theme park instead of blowing it up. Corporations don't want to be evil. They don't know how. They don't know how to take advantage of what you're doing. They're almost oblivious to what you're doing, what this event is about. But I can tell you right now, they're very hungry. Look at a Best Buy. I mean, they're looking at the Amazons, the Costcos, everybody's selling flat screens. But Dell is now inside of there. So every business has their Achilles heel. And I think that developing the rapid prototyping capability, for example, inside the company, nobody tries a lot of quick things because you have to go through the IT department. And unless it's a billion-dollar idea, and most billion-dollar businesses start out as $500 ideas, nobody's trying out the $500 ideas because it costs $100,000 to get an estimate to scale anything. So nobody tries. If we could allow, I envision, Dan teaching classes in public-private partnerships with the universities who also want to be more competitive, somehow giving you access to the leverage that the big companies have and showing them how to prototype ideas a lot quicker. Imagine a matchup or an API for a BestBuy.com. That's what I'm trying to do, is to say, boy, the development environments, if you could teach the IT departments to create these kind of playful sandboxes and give people access, then you kind of combine the best of both. And that's why I think one of the answers is because the big companies want to be innovative like startups, and startups want to grow. And so that's kind of the framework from my perspective.
It's a huge opportunity, by the way, for us locally that Robert is and Best Buy is kind of indulging this point of view, and you're kind of a subversive in some ways on this issue. We've got a team of folks who's focused on engaging with the venture community. Robert is obviously very entrepreneurial. That's a new development, and I think something, it's a great opportunity for folks to try to figure out how can we leverage. Best Buy wants to get very active into the services business and recurring revenue streams over time. What are the opportunities we all have to partner, use that leverage to just absolutely blow up a company big, much more quickly, in a way that works for Best Buy, works for the company, is more capital efficient. That's something that the code hasn't been completely cracked on. Obviously, Geekscout was a great acquisition, but I think they're working on it and they're actively engaged. So hopefully the fact that Robert's making these connections, we can continue to
Yeah, I don't want to keep going on. I just want to say one thing. What I'm trying to do is figure out some kind of like a corporate API. Okay. That would, because if we can show up one company, maybe we can get 3M, Cargill, and General Mills to allow you in. Because even though these businesses aren't high tech, that's actually where some of the opportunities might be. But imagine some kind of an API where we can get the IS department to calm down. And so by showing them what's possible, every time this Web 2.0 with new applications like CrashPlan is awesome. That probably never would have been built inside of Best Buy. But I have the power now to put that on every single computer that they sell. So that's where hopefully we can come up with some hybrid way, because I know all of you have so many different amazing ideas, and the meetings at these corporate rooms are just so boring. but that's where the opportunity is. And it's not that they don't want to do it. They need help on figuring it out. We got to figure out ways to allow more mashups and stuff.
Number of questions popped up. Whoa.
Cover yours.
I was curious if you could address how your conversation here, which was interesting, relates to the whole notion of open source.
Well, maybe I'll step up here. I think I'm a developer first and a business person second. I started developing actually in 79 in Minnesota. Using any computer I could find at a college campus, so even downtown Dayton, if you remember that, they used to have a computer department.
I used to work there.
Yeah, exactly. you know, and ever since the 80s, I've been trying to coin this phrase, Silicon Prairie. That's where we're at, you know, to try and say, because even then, back in the early 80s, you know, I was talking with guys in Silicon Valley, and they had this attitude, like, they were better, like they had all the technology, and we were inventing things here in the Midwest. Then we weren't known. I'd go for a wedding on the West Coast, and I'd tell them what I do, and they'd look at me like, "Really? Where are you again? How does that work?" You know, they don't believe it. I was recently out in Silicon Valley, and it's a different culture, it's a different environment. The reason I bring up kind of the history is because I think my perspective, you know, being an entrepreneur in Minnesota, is really hard for me personally. And I think open source has, for me personally, reduced a lot of barriers. The cost of technology keeps dropping, I can try new things, and perhaps more importantly, ever since even the first web page, I can see how things are built. I can teach myself, how did they do that? That looks cool, view source on that web page, right? You know, that's a great database, but how did they do that? I can dig in, I can look at it. And I think here in Minnesota, we have this sort of, we're really smart, in terms of developers and student developers, not with these guys. We're really smart and we're focused, we're self-taught, we're disciplined, we understand, we have a great sense of customer value, but we're risk-averse. And it's that risk-averseness that holds us back. We work for the banks, we create value in these large organizations because that's what we were taught to do as kids here in the Midwest. It didn't matter how smart we were. So I think the biggest challenge, kind of going back to Dan, is just to knock down this barrier of avoiding risk. There's no reason, especially with open source, that you can't get started tonight with an idea. Download a virtual machine, get started, run on a cloud, perhaps even free. There's nothing holding you back to try out that idea. So, you know, let's get started, let's make it happen. And maybe someday people will actually say Silicon Prairie instead of, you know, corn country or flyover or whatever.
So any thoughts on going from, you started out building products for other people, and now you're building your own products. Would you recommend folks go that path? We're doing it on someone else's nickel. Want to jump right to the idea? Is there?
That was a mistake. Actually, it was covering my mind. You know, you go where the passion is. If you have an itch, you know, back to the, some of these themes, if there's something that you believe in and you want to do that first. And the younger that you are, the better I think it is in terms of responsibility and getting started, start early. I think it was a mistake for Code42. We sat in a room before we incorporated. We said, what are we going to be as a company? We said, we're going to be Adobe. We're going to be Google. We're going to be this product company. And then what did we go do? We became a geek squad for software. You know, we did services. Why? Because we're risk averse and we better build up the bankroll first. And we wasted our time, largely, because we'd already been working together as a team. We knew how to build products. We wasted 5 years. We could have been to market that much sooner. The bang and crash line is doing very well. We're thrilled. We could have been here 3 years ago. And you know, we might be out there further and more well known. And as it is now, we're, you know, we're scratching and clawing to get attention in the marketplace.
Well, and to answer your question, then I'll shut up because I'm talking too much. You mentioned about open source. These days, the open source toolkits are so good that I can take 2-3 people and put together a product that before would have taken me 15 or 20 people and $20 million in venture money. And so it doesn't mean that every company is going to be a $1 billion company. What it means is you can look at some smaller opportunities, because you can take something that might be a really rich business for you and your partners and build a quality product around that, that 10 years ago you couldn't have gotten funded because it would never have been a $1 billion market. So the tools have come up, and open source has driven that. So I think there's a big open source component to that.
Matthew, would you have started your crash plan today without 442 behind it?
Would I have started crash? Absolutely.
Would you be able to?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
It doesn't take a lot of money to write software. It takes guts. Yeah. It takes confidence. And it takes boldness, frankly. And I don't care whether you're an entrepreneur, and I've done that, or whether you're in a big company and you're trying to make a difference. Be bold and do what you think is right. And frankly, even inside, especially in corporations, that's appreciated way more than you think it is. So the timidness, the risk averseness, I will say, of the Midwest is definitely an issue. And I just think we need more people who are willing to stand up and to do what's right.
And if I can, you brought up the open source model, and so people have already covered what that means for startups, efficiency, and leverage, which is all very relevant. But I'd like to step back from that and really look at open source and say, yeah, there's open source as a movement, there's open source as a political idea, there's open source as a business model, but what about just open source as a means of building things, right? There's so much for us to learn from that. And, you know, dovetailing off of what Michael was saying about, you have to look at the level of greatness at an absolute scale. You know, we've had a development team in Minneapolis for a decade, and we've been acquired. There's been magnetism and gravity pulling people to the coast. Why has that never changed? Because it was great. You couldn't build it better in the coast. So why would you screw that up? And what I think is interesting about that, dovetailing with open source, is that part of what we have to do in the ethos of building companies and building software is to move beyond place. You know, show me how many open source packages out there are built by people that all go to an office and sit in a room together, or can even have the same driver's license state. They don't. You know, great examples of even big, large, successful companies like Skype, where, you know, the rumor is no two developers live in the same city, and, you know, maybe there's some exceptions to that. But, you know, we don't have to look at geography as this inherent limiter. Open source doesn't. Open source is able to tap onto passion, which is what you really need to care about. And so I think the lesson that we learned from Minnesota companies in open source is look at it as a means of developing software and developing product, and what can you learn from that? And that has nothing to do with your business model and your revenue model. And just take that as a given and see where that takes you. And I think it allows you to do some really great things.
Yes, I just wanted to follow up on the question or comment the gentleman from Microsoft and the U of M. I've coached a Lego robotics team for 6 years. They're all high school seniors. None of the six even looked at the University of Minnesota. None of them are staying in Minnesota. They're going to Carnegie Mellon and Rose Holm and MIT. And my experience with the other teams is this is not atypical. And so you got to have a good minor league, and they're all leaving the state.
Yeah, and by the way, I mean, I've been trying to find a way to make a difference without spending a lot of time in the state, unfortunately. But frankly, we've got to be able to grow our children and our children's children in around an institution or in an institution that embraces the best of the best. And that's just difficult if you don't have a Carnegie Mellon, if you don't have a Stanford, if you don't have a kick your pick.
I'm starting even younger. You know, when I had my company that first started up, I could only hire people really kind of in their 20s. They had to have a couple years of experience. Now you can be 16 years old and work for us, just starting out doing, you know, basic RAM installs. So we kind of see ourselves as even potentially a feeder for the industry. Those of you that are friends of Make Magazine from O'Reilly, which I absolutely love, I think is one of the key ways. We introduced TPT, Twin Cities Public Television, we brought them to the first Makers Fair a couple years ago. And they were talking to Discovery Channel, and backed off because Discovery Channel is kind of commercial. So TPT is going to start Make TV this fall. and we're going to be the sole founding sponsor of that. I'd like to see a minibar. I think the sooner we get people to start to figure out this stuff, it's not that hard. And I give a lot of talks to high schools, and I say, you know, if I had started my company when I was 12, I'd be a billionaire. I'd like to see another version of this for the kids to come, because it's not that hard. I mean, I think their software development is easier, and they're going to be more experienced if they can start sooner. And anything that we can do, I think will kind of help that.
One thing, just comment on the university, because I think one thing we all have to acknowledge is there are some people doing great work inside the university. And this is our research university. This state, every entrepreneurial region, every place, is got at its core a great research university. Minnesota's only national research university is the University of Minnesota. So I think if we want to succeed ultimately as a region, this university needs to thrive and succeed. And I think we should try to not look at that as an independent variable of our activity, but a dependent variable on how we engage and how we work with the folks who are here, how we articulate to the leaders in the state how we would like to see the university funded. All of those things are a part of making the university. So let's take ownership of making the university what we hope it will be and can be, because there are folks inside the university, I think, who care deeply about continuing to build the strongest possible technical foundation in this community. They absolutely do. Folks like John Riedel and Vipin Kumar and other folks who are doing lots of great work in this regard, and in fact are recruiting great junior faculty from other places. But we're not where we all want to be, certainly. Let's just take it as lighting the candle as opposed to cursing the darkness.
Unless you can yell your questions, you come over here.
I'll yell. All right. Just really quickly, in terms of growing the industry, this is great. And since conference organizers work their butt off and often don't get recognized, thank you for putting on a conference like this. This is a great, great contribution for our industry.
I'd like to follow on the heels of that. And I'm actually here in the opposite role. I'm here as a business person that's kind of a developer, but enough of a developer know that I need to be here to find better developers. And I'm actually running into a problem of finding those developers because they are all taking off. And I'm wondering if the panel has any ideas as to connecting entrepreneurial mindsets with the technology components that can create better ventures and stay in the Twin Cities.
Well, the problem is geeks don't know how to throw good parties usually. So if you're a good business person, you know how to promote and you're kind of the business angle, I recommend we start the International Kung Fu Film Festival, because there's only really one crowd of people that are going to show up for that.
And to push back, you know, some of the business events that do take place, some of the mixers, I mean, they're dirty in a sense, where you're there for a 30-second pitch and you move on. And it's, no, these genuine connection opportunities are great, but it happens, what, once a year. Are there any other opportunities that you guys know of?
Four times a year.
Really?
Yeah, we have quarterly nightly events called mini demos. We'll talk about that later.
Okay.
Following up on what he was saying, more than he was talking about the entrepreneurial management part of it, we actually have been developing a product with another company, and we have a prototype that's been bought by a lot of companies. We can't find the next level of funding because we are engineers. We don't know the venture capital market here so well. I've heard a lot of people say, move your company to California, you'll find more money there. I think that connection needs to be done here, otherwise people will keep moving to California. We're actually talking to one CEO who moved his company to California because it's better there in terms of money. So
if I can jump in a little bit, when Michael was talking about the caliber of the people, that's the ultimate thing here. I'm talking with a company right now about being their CEO, and they're in Ottawa. And so it's not the location, I don't think. I think it's the quality of the people. And so I think that it's easy to be a developer and stay in your safe spot. It's uncomfortable to call people. It's uncomfortable to go out and try to make these connections with folks. And so if you can, and psychologists say it takes 6 months of doing something before you get comfortable with it. Really early in my career, I made a year's worth of telesales phone calls. And having that, basically getting beat up for a year means I'll call anyone. And I'm 5,000 miles to coffee shops last year, and I hate coffee. But that's where business gets done. So I think you have to kind of come to these events and completely work the room, and then you find the folks, and you connect, we're all very closely
interwoven. I was listening to the conversations up here. Everyone on the out here and folks out there, you have connections with people all over the country in leadership roles and this and that. And so you've got a compelling idea. You can get the person, but you just got to work at it. You got to work at it like you worked at the product. And you bring that together, and then you can get funding.
Just one quick comment. Back to your point about how do you find people, and you know, far and away, the best way to find great people is through networking. It is not through hiring a recruiter. The thing is, how do you start that? I mean, you got to find a great developer to start that. But this is a great opportunity to network with good people. So,
a couple of things I want to follow up on this as well, because I think it's a very important topic, and is often there's the dynamic that a company believes that it's developed something compelling, but then hits a wall, and because they can't find funding, and they can't find funding, and they think the funding's necessary to get the people, but the funding requires some component of the people to be in place, and that is absolutely somewhat of a chicken and egg. But what in general has been my experience is that great ideas do collect great people, and so if it is a compelling proposition, getting exposure. Presuming that there are folks out there on the business side who are capable of understanding what you're doing and can recognize it and see it for hopefully what it is, that it can, but it requires getting out and exposing it. And it is a necessary precondition in many ways. What somebody is saying when they say move your company to California is by and large, move it to California because we have other management in denser and in more availability than you may have there. And we will populate your team with those managers. And that may be exactly the right thing for your business. It may not be the right thing for your business, but I don't think anybody should presume that same engineering-driven team alone just goes out to Silicon Valley and it's funded without the presumption of the business people and the teams that are coming in. That is absolutely not the case. What they're saying is we're able to populate it or fill it in based on people who are on deck. So I think the question should be, as a starting point, if you... Engineers, I think, can easily diminish the importance of good business people, because what the engineers and the developers do is really, really hard, and it doesn't seem as hard to be a marketing guy or a sales guy or just go out and raise money because it's a freaking compelling product. Well, that isn't the way the investment world looks at it, because there's lots of great technologies that have done nothing and sat on the vine because they weren't able to be marketed. We weren't able to solve a specific compelling customer need, even though the technology itself was inherently cool. And the investors are keenly aware of that. But fundamentally, we've got to back a team that's capable of turning a compelling opportunity into a compelling business. And that requires business people to be working with deeply technical people. So I think as you're taking these risks, and as you're doing what this team is suggesting, and folks are thinking about that, make sure you're taking the risk in its full form, which is I want to develop a great product and I want to develop a great team to build a compelling business, not just the technical side. So you've got to have both of those hats on when you are working in this, or it will unfortunately be lopsided and it won't fulfill your aspirations.
Okay. I want to support Michael on that statement. You know, again, I'm a developer. One of the hardest things I've had to do in my life after building CrashPlan was write a product brochure. I mean, it you know, I still have scars from it. So, thankfully, I was blessed. My wife is a marketing person, and she was able to, you know, kind of gently help me through that exercise of explaining why people should use the product. So, absolutely, if you're starting something, if you're an engineer, it's not enough. Go find someone that can communicate like a regular person and go to coffee shops. You'll go a lot further. Start off that way. And you know, also to support, you know, the idea, if you don't do it alone, find a partner, find three. You know, Google's a triumvirate, right? Don't do it alone. And if it's a good idea, you'll get the right talent, get the right people, and you'll succeed.
Well, lastly, there's another model that's emerging, and that is, you know, Best Buy started an internal VC fund. We're seeing a lot more startups get acquired right away by Yahoo or Google. So there's another option that's out there, and that is the corporation as investor, because they can provide marketing. Any of you that own Sling Boxes, that was a startup that went straight into the retail shelf with an investment by the retailer. And I think that the more choices you have for funding, because some of those products might need that leverage, that instant kickstart, instead of going through your normal process where you have to do the marketing yourself, hopefully freeing you up to just focus on the actual features and capabilities of the product.
It is funny how you mentioned that the people who started Slimbox were out of the Bay Area. We're actually had many, many hardware startups to their credit already, so they had a lot of experience in that. But I get it.
I got a note for Michael. Obviously, Michael, that the funding today for Web2O companies is much lower than it used to be for funding a startup.
You mean the funding requirements?
Funding requirements, okay. Yes, dollar-wise. Do you see this continuing to be filled by, is it angels that are going to have to pick up this gap, as it's been called? Or are VCs, like your own firm, going to be coming further down and doing smaller investments?
I think it will be both. I also think that the notion that fundamentally everything is going to be built on $500,000 and then acquired by Google for $20 million is really misguided, and I think undersells how hard it is to build and undershoots the aspiration for a lot of technology. I think a lot of Web 2.0 things do need to leverage another platform. And to build them to scale isn't going to make sense. And so fundamentally, they are building a feature or a product addition for what is an existing platform. And those are very interesting investment opportunities. Some of them, on a personal basis, you would love to have created. But from the investment community standpoint, we are hoping that people in this room are also out to try to build businesses that are $100 million in revenue, have the chance to be meaningful, scalable players in the business. And not everything is going to fit into the Web 2.0 small footprint orientation. So in that case, there's going to need to be more capital. But I think you're raising an absolutely appropriate point, Graham, which is the venture community has been trying to figure out what's the best way to play in that. There has been a lot of dollars blown on Web 2.0 with the presumption that one of the big three was just going to save everybody, independent of the lack of business model, or just get a bunch of users and they'll pipe it right in and Google will save the day. So I think that we should hold ourselves to a higher standard of what we want the business to be than that, and I hope that's the case. But the venture community has to adapt and modify as well. We perhaps are often slow to do that and can be hidebound in our ways and expectations. I think that's a fair challenge to the venture community to figure out how to adapt into this world. The bottom line is what we're trying to do is back teams that are building compelling businesses. Some of those are going to be, we hope, big scalable businesses that will need more capital. But we can't make a business model of, we hope this company gets acquired for $10 million. That just isn't going to work for our investors who are expecting different things out of us. So there's that, more of that will be probably populated by angel funding in smaller dollars.
Do you see yourselves working closer with angels?
We'd love to work with angels. We meet with Twin Cities Angels folks regularly in the Valley. We have relationships with folks in the angel community. We see angels as an absolutely critical component of the overall ecosystem that supports emerging companies. How can you have anything but respect? By and large, angels are people who have found success and who want to put that back in to helping a company succeed. Historically, there's been more of a conflict orientation between angels and VCs, because the angels get frustrated by the fact that the company does need more capital, the VCs come in and ownership gets diluted. I think there's a much more balanced dynamic between angels and VCs now, and where angels are saying, I'm not going to go into this company unless I believe I can secure my ownership position over a longer period of time and that the VCs aren't going to crush me. But that also requires a business plan that is capital efficient. And it doesn't need $100 million to become profitable and the like. So that, but those conversations are absolutely going on, and hopefully in a pretty open-minded, good faith manner. I think everybody in the technology community right now, whether they're on the investing side or the entrepreneur side, is saying, where is their white space? Where is there an opportunity to build something meaningful? And what's the best way to fund it? And that equation is changing from what it was 10 years ago. Who knows exactly what it'll be going forward?
I'll put my question up front here first, and then get to Nick.
Thanks. After you guys went to these first
a few events, mini bar and mini demo. A bunch of us got together and started Minovate, MINOV8.com, mainly because we wanted to have something that we could read ourselves about what was happening with web and internet technology innovation in the state of Minnesota. So check it out. But the question is related to that. Now that you can't pick up a trade rag or look at any magazine or read anything on the web without everybody talking about the morphing to cloud computing and what Amazon's doing and what Google's doing and what Microsoft is doing with Mesh and with rich internet applications and all that, in terms of each one of you, what do you see as the next big category, the next big opportunity for development and application deployment? Or maybe that's too big.
I just haven't had this opportunity. Because I've been developing since 79, I was an early Sherwin author. I developed a product for business. I'm pretty good at predicting the future in general. I'm known for not so much as being I have a lot of fall failings, but I'm pretty good at having a general sense of where things are going. I've never seen an opportunity like I have in the mobile space. The iPhone, Google's new platform is coming out. If I was starting anything right now, I would look there. Remember we're going back to the business and the marketing thing. The fact that Apple is going to give you a channel where you don't have to worry about e-commerce and you don't have to worry about marketing and sales, and you don't even necessarily have to be there first, right? I mean, white space is a good thing, but competition is fun, and we're really smart here, and we're aggressive, and we have a good sense of design in this state. So, I would, without a doubt, I would build something on the iPhone or look further ahead towards Android. But definitely the iPhone. I mean, you have Apple's very good at marketing, and you get all of that for free. So that would be my 2 cents.
I was going to say, I work for Microsoft and I have an iPhone.
Well, and on Monday, Minnesota company announced $2.2 billion investment in the biggest mobile phone retailer in Europe. Absolutely agree. There are more mobile phones than all televisions and computers combined. Just going to be huge.
Nick, do you want to say something?
Okay. I'm Nick Bowman, and I work under the venture umbrella that is inside Best Buy. One of the things that I wish my boss were here right now, because he's on the coast, so this is kind of
a problem.
One of the mantras that we have is the team that fails the fastest and the earliest and the most often is the team that wins. And to your discussion about risk, that is a great mantra, and it does work, but it's really, really hard. And it's hard on developers, too. I almost feel like we need to develop like a support group for risk. To make more mistakes, you know. That's all I have.
That's our natural advantage. We suffer here. To harsh conditions. We take it. It's that Minnesota nice, which is really a secret passive aggressiveness. Innovation is a numbers game, and that's why I'm all for sky's the limit. My head is in the clouds about it. You know, I think the more we just play with what's possible, the more stratas are going to emerge of different types of businesses, pure product plays, or quick features that are acquired for a relatively small amount of money, because doing that is going to give all of you the experience in the areas that you need to build out to bridge the gap to where your kind of strengths are now, from leadership to marketing. You should be hanging out with all the students at MCAD. I mean, those are just people waiting to do something with design, and they're all dressed up with no place to go, and I see a perfect opportunity there alone.
I need to hire some of those folks. So.
And they're cheap. They're eating ramen noodle every day.
With all the talent here in Minnesota, why haven't we seen a breakout Web 2.0 startup come out of here yet?
How about just a breakout startup?
I'm sorry?
How about just a breakout internet startup? Forget about Web 2.0. We don't have...
Maybe it's Matthew. I don't know.
One of the things about the coast, right? I mean, it started with Hewlett Packard in the Valley, right? And led to Apple and new companies, and Stanford was part of that and all that. you know, Microsoft in Seattle, you know, University of Washington and Seattle, and obviously Microsoft, and it's become this anchor, and Bowen was there. You know, one thing, we had a point in time where we had control data, we had Unisys, Sperry, whatever, they were all here, major companies, and unfortunately that kind of evaporated. And I think a lot of us can trace our lineage to those companies that went away. We don't have a replacement. 3M's not a replacement because they're manufacturing. You know, there's not a software equivalent here. And that is an issue. And I don't know how or where that happens. Best Buy is awesome, but again, Best Buy is in the products, consumer products company. So anyways, I don't have an answer, but it's a concern.
Okay.
Why Web 2.0? I mean,
yeah, why not?
Web 3.
Yeah.
Hybrid apps, there's now three platforms, right? Desktop, rich, web, and mobile device. And your solution should work equally well across all three.
I think you're
don't do it yourself.
If you're focusing on two, you're probably too late.
Yeah. I personally have a tremendous amount of fatigue for social apps right now. I don't want to hear yet another. It's my space for playing. We can't chase what's been funded and then try to twist it 5% and expect to get disproportionately rewarded. You want disproportionately rewarded, come up with a disproportionately unique idea.
Yeah, Minnesota's developed anti-social networking, right? Typical answer from a Minnesotan.
I'd like to speak to people together working designers and developers. The University of Minnesota has success in connecting researchers across departments through events like speed dating. You know, we could maybe attempt something like that.
I think that's maybe a concept we could follow up on with Luke, Ben, Dan. I mean, how do we extend what this is clearly emerging into something that continues to bridge those gaps? Because until we're there, we're not there. And I think your point is right on. I mean, if we look at, we invest our fund regularly in the medical device industry as well. The medical device ecosystem that exists in Minnesota is the equivalent of the Silicon Valley ecosystem in IT. You've got, essentially, if you put it in, you know, use the metaphor too far, but you've got old growth sequoias, you've got, you know, mid-range trees that are there, and then down underneath the canopy, you've got saplings by the bucket load. And the soil is fertile, everything's there. That is working in Minnesota in the medical device space. So you would bring in world-class executives from around business people, in addition to the technical people. They've seen wealth creation that has come through the growth and explosion of emerging companies. They get acquired. Those folks then say, let's go turn around and do it again. And that's exactly what the dynamic is, that flywheel that is at work in Silicon Valley. I think where we are in Minnesota is we've got some companies that are aspiring to be breakout and major consolidators. I think Digital River is doing that as an inherently kind of web-native company. And there are others that are emerging companies, hopefully some of them on this table. But until we're there, we're not there. And I think that's when we are in the position of leading companies, defining the space, and consolidating that space eventually, hopefully being leading public companies that are attracting talent from all over. And the thing that I think we should take some encouragement from is that it doesn't require 50 of them. Things change with one company. One company can change a region. Two companies can change a region if you think about the dynamic. Think about Seattle without Microsoft. Think about Austin without Dell. Michael Dell and Bill Gates, that's where they grew up. That's where Michael Dell went to college, right? I mean, that's Seymour Cray, Chippewa Falls. That's the reason Cray was here, nothing else. And at the end of the day, hopefully people in this room or people with whom you work are those individuals, because at the end of the day, a small number of people are the breakout individuals around whom the lightning is bottled and then it takes off. So I don't know, we can't legislate it. We can't just pour capital. That isn't what's going to do it. It comes down to entrepreneurial magic that eventually creates a breakout company, which redefines the region. And we all, I think, aspire to that. But that's when we'll know we're there.
We ran a little over because we did start a little late. I know this could probably go on for the rest of the day. You get a lot of good info from these guys. But I want to kind of say, you know, we could go on 10, 15 more minutes. And then we just have to break at 2, sessions start again. There is pizza out there now. And so, I don't know, I'm kind of throwing it up to the panel what they want to do. If you want to keep speaking grilled for a little bit, or should we just break out and then you can answer your questions, ask them of them independently. What do you think?
Keep going?
All right, if you think some people want to get pizza, you can bring it back in and have
it. If you want to ask a question, you got to give us a piece of pizza.
All right, so I saw some more. You can go up here to get this if you want.
Thank you.